Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, we'll hear about what happened at the 93rd Annual Winter Mayors Conference in Washington, D.C. Also, Jay Fox will speak with an expert about mental health training for teachers. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective,
Christina Marin is the Republican mayor of Findlay in Northwest Ohio. She's on the advisory board and attended the 93rd winter meeting of the United States Conference of Mayors and joins us on Columbus Perspective. Welcome, Madam Mayor.
Thank you.
What happens at a mayor's conference?
A lot of talking, a lot of discussion, a lot of many therapy sessions, I think, at times among the mayors occur. But it's always a whirlwind, especially at the D.C. meeting. There's a lot jam-packed and people trying to meet with members of Congress and the senators. And then certainly with the inauguration going on, it was a little bit chaotic.
Are these just bigger city mayors, or are there smaller city mayors represented as well?
No, there are definitely smaller city mayors. So to be a full member of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, you have to be 30,000, a population of 30,000 or more. But they also have associate mayors that are less than 30,000 that are able to attend and participate. They're just not voting members. So there certainly are a lot of the big city mayors, Atlanta, New York, Detroit, Cleveland, all of those communities certainly attend. But the majority of cities are less than 100,000 across the United States. And so there certainly is a lot of discussion that goes on among those mayors as well.
So how many Ohio mayors are members?
Our members, there's probably at least, there's over 10 for sure. But I think this meeting we had 12 or 16 that attended as well, some of them being associate mayors. Upper Arlington was in attendance, New Albany was in attendance. But Elyria, Lorain, Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Toledo, Lima, and myself are all very engaged in the conference. And so we were all in attendance as well.
So give us a peek behind the curtain, Mayor. What were some of the hot issues of discussion at this winter meeting?
I think the big things were, obviously with the presidential transition, just what to expect. And I think the consensus was, we don't want to react to things until we see kind of how they really play out. Mayors are responsible to get things done with any administration. So we had a good previous working relation with the Trump administration, certainly worked with the Biden administration. And now going back to the Trump administration, we'll be looking for ways to collaborate and work to move our communities and nation forward. Housing is certainly a huge topic. And Columbus Mayor Andy Ginther is the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors this year. And that is kind of his main thing. There are a housing shortage of millions of homes across the United States at all different types of price points and types. And I know in the city of Findlay, that's something that we are continually talking about. How do we help spur development when we have such easy processes to start with? And really right now we're looking at how do we help decrease the cost of adding infrastructure to new residential development. So housing certainly was a top one. I always enjoy attending and talking about the public-private partnerships and kind of trying to spur ideas on how we can, as a city, can partner with private investors to get things done in our community. And then I spoke on child care. Again, a key driver of our economy is getting more people into the workforce. And we know that there is a shortage across the nation, and certainly Findlay is no exception. Hancock County, we have a deficit of 10 to 1. For every one child care spot, we have 10 people that are interested in it. And so figuring out how we have more affordable, high quality, and accessible child care is certainly a topic that I spent a lot of time on at the conference, and I'm very interested in how we continue to work to address that in the Findlay and Hancock County community. So those are just a couple of the things.
Sure.
Like I said, it was a busy couple of days.
It appears that the Trump administration is moving in the direction of decentralization and giving more power to state, county, and local governments. How will that impact the mayoral role going forward?
Yeah, I think mayors are very open to that. We recognize that when the money is getting closest to the people, when local communities are able to make decisions on behalf of their constituents, we have more effective communities. We saw that during the COVID pandemic when revenue sources were coming directly to our communities and we were having more flexibility. I think we're excited about that potential. However, I think there's also a little apprehension that it could create some chaos. You know, when you have communities across the state, you know, doing things a little different in every community, or maybe it being pushed to the states, but maybe the state's not necessarily giving that full authority down to their local municipalities. I think cities are always apprehensive that the state is going to, you know, kind of take over and not give us the authority, especially in Ohio, home rule state, making sure that we have those opportunities to best serve our constituents. So I think we're really watching and really just trying to share the message that we want to be a part of the conversation. And we're not always going to agree on everything, but we certainly understand kind of the operational level of how changes in federal policy, federal administration impact our communities, and want to be able to share things proactively rather than reactively.
So you're on the advisory board. What responsibilities come with that title specifically?
Yeah, so the advisory board is a smaller group of mayors that meet an additional two times a year to kind of set out strategy, meet with cabinet members, meet with different partners, but really kind of dig into what are the big challenges we're seeing. Again, at the winter conference and the annual meeting, it's such a whirlwind that there's kind of short little tidbits of information. In the leadership meetings, we typically dig deeper into one or two topics and then kind of determine what we want to move forward with the organization as a whole. But one of the big parts of those meetings is also having more national leaders come in and have kind of conversations with us to provide some of that proactive communication on what we're seeing. And typically it also opens doors where I'm invited more regularly to events, including, you know, I've been to the White House multiple times under the Trump administration, previously meeting on housing, on transportation, on the vaccine summit, under the Biden administration, on infrastructure and local control. And so it really just opens up opportunities for us to represent mayors from across the country and share our perspective on things that are positive and negatively going on at the federal level.
So we've got you on the advisory board. Cleveland Mayor Justin Bibb is a trustee this year. And you mentioned Andrew Ginther, our Columbus mayor, is the president. And of course, J.D. Vance from Southern Ohio is the vice president. So Ohio is very well represented, wouldn't you say?
Oh, definitely. All of the other mayors across the country frequently joke about the fact that Ohio mayors run the conference, and that we are ones, you know, that are typically, I don't want to say loud, but we don't have a problem sharing our opinions on things and sharing what we're doing. And I think a part of that is that we are also very well organized in the state of Ohio with the Ohio Mayors Alliance, that we talk regularly to each other. So we have a kind of common voice on a lot of issues. So that really helps both the United States Conference of Mayors, but other mayors across the country where they can look to Ohio as an example of best practice. So we're excited to have J.D. Vance as the vice president and certainly work with him and make sure he remembers the great state of Ohio. And then, of course, just because I have to slip it in, we obviously had the Buckeyes win. So we're starting off the year strong.
Absolutely. So there's only one way to end this interview. OH?
IO.
You know that's right. Mayor Christina Murren from Finley, thanks for being on the show today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
It is estimated that there are almost 110,000 students in Columbus and vicinity. Add to that another 60,000 at Ohio State University and other nearby colleges. A new poll from the American Psychiatric Association shows Americans are supportive of mental health education and the importance of school staff participating in mental health trainings. In fact, 84% of Americans believe school staff plays a crucial role in identifying signs of mental health issues in students. But here's the rub. Less than half 45% believe most school staff have been trained in identifying these concerns. Raul Andrews Jr. is the executive director of the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, and we thank you for speaking with us today. Why has it taken so long for mental health to come to the forefront of our attention when it comes to student wellness?
I want to thank you for giving us an opportunity to come forward. The APA Foundation stands upon a premise that there is no health without mental health. And so the quick answer to your question, Jay, is that for too many centuries, we have not prioritized our mental health and well-being equally with the way we prioritize our physical health. And so because of that lack of prioritization, it's taken longer than it should have.
There are a lot of schools that have RAP counseling programs, but we hear throughout Central Ohio that there is a shortage of mental health counselors in schools. Why has that been the case?
Well, some of it is about education, some of it is about time, and some of it is about people's choices of what type of professions they want to promote. And again, because we haven't prioritized mental health, we haven't prioritized actually directing our advancing students into looking at these careers. The bright light is that because of the negatives around the pandemic and other things, mental health is at the forefront. It probably is at the forefront for the foreseeable future. And so we do see an increase in interest in people pursuing these types of careers in mental health counseling and support. We also see it at the medical school level, where more medical students are looking at psychiatry as a profession. But we can't wait until training is over, Jay. And that's why I'm pleased to tell you and your listening audience that the APA Foundation has secured a federal grant to provide some non-medical training around mental health services and support to our K-12 students nationwide. It's called Notice Talk Act at School. We can do that at no cost to the school and no cost to the parent for less than 3 hours per session.
Now, I've taken mental health first aid myself, and I know that in school, behavioral issues have always been the case and will continue to persist, but now we're dealing with understanding anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and things that happen outside the school that impact the student's daily life in the school. To what degree does the Notice Talk Act program address the specificity of those issues?
So one of the things that we look at Notice Talk Act at School, and we're glad to have the federal grant and grateful for it, is that we look at it as the stop, drop, and roll, Jay, for mental health services support by school staff right now. And when I say stop, drop, and roll, most of your listening audience knows that that didn't turn anybody into a first responder. But they were better equipped to help somebody if there was an emergency related to flame retardation with a fire. So here with Notice Talk Act at School, what we're talking about is if I'm a school teacher, if I'm a counselor, if I'm a cafeteria worker or a bus driver, and if I see something, what do I do when I notice the signs and symptoms of student distress? And then how can I engage in the talk in a courageous and comfortable conversation with that student versus a difficult conversation to see what might really be going on? And then finally, if I get in that conversation, I got to have ready at my disposal some non-medical tools, tips, and resources to try to get these young scholars some help if they need it. And so that's what we believe can happen, is that even if you've taken mental health first aid, and we're not against that, anything we can do to get a little bit better to deal with new challenges post-pandemic, we strongly encourage it, and we strongly encourage that people go to apaf.org/schools, and just take a look at it and see whether or not this is the kind of resource that could help our students and our school community right now.
Now, does this also help with identifying undiagnosed attention deficit disorders?
So I talked to my doctors, and what they've told me is this is not a diagnostic tool. All you're going to be able to do is notice signs and symptoms, and that might lead to referring somebody to a physician to get a diagnosis. But what we're going to be seeing, Jay, is looking for mood changes that are atypical. We're going to be looking for symptoms of withdrawal. The person who loved their fall sport, football, now all of a sudden wants to quit or is not engaging. The person who was in drama no longer wants to be there. The person who's been a high-performing student all of a sudden seems withdrawn, even in the early days of a new academic year. When these things are happening, a lot of times our school staff, according to our poll, you know, over 4 out of 5 Americans think school staff have to play a role. But as you told your audience, only 45% believe that the whole school staff is being brought up to speed about what's really going on and how they can be helpful. And we know, and we thank our educators because we know they want to be helpful.
Do urban areas such as Columbus, Ohio, have greater risk for mental health issues in students, or is it the same regardless of where you are?
So I don't think there is a zip code issue here, Jay, and so it's not really an urban, suburban, or rural. The challenge in a lot of our urban school settings is that you do have a larger student population more times than others, and so it might be more difficult for the school cafeteria worker or the coach or the principal or the homeroom teacher in a bigger school to notice when there are signs of distress because they're dealing with so many other issues and so many other students. In a smaller school setting where the one-to-one ratio might be smaller, doesn't mean we don't have distress, but it might be easier to see that Raul is more easily irritated this year than he seemed to be last year. And I wonder what's happening with Raul. And we can have those easier one-to-one conversations. But what Notice Talk Act tries to do is get some help when we're at that point of seeing that there's something that seems atypical.
Is there any liability for the teachers in this program, or is that something that's covered by the schools?
So, again, because this isn't a diagnostic tool, nobody has told us that there's any liability for the school employing it any more than there would have been liability for the school to employ other training programs like mental health first aid that you mentioned. You know, the difference is it doesn't cost the school anything. The difference is it doesn't cost parents anything. The difference is it only takes 2 to 2.5 hours to get some training. And this is one of the reasons, Jay, why we've been strongly encouraged to focus on the adults, not the children. Yes, if we were directly working with students in the program, there might be other risk factors to APA Foundation or teachers. But because we're adults talking to adults about the issues that are happening in school, we think they're better equipped to understand context and nuance. And when they have context and nuance, what ends up happening is one of two things. You either say, we want this training, we're going to go to apaf.org/schools, and we want to do a big school training. Or, on the flip side, we want to do a train-the-trainer model to further reduce any risk because Mr. J is going to teach Mr. J's school after he learns the program from APA Foundation, not some outsider coming in trying to change how the school does some things. And we want it to be comfortable for the faculty and staff as well.
Mental health training for teachers, a necessity in this day and age. We want to thank Raul Andrews Jr., the executive director of the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
President Donald Trump kicked off his second administration with a blitz of policy actions to overhaul the U.S. government. His executive orders cover issues that range from immigration to government operation, health care, diversity, equity and inclusion, and the economy. Some have made an immediate policy impact. Others are more symbolic, and some are already being challenged in federal lawsuits. Thanks for joining us for Face the State. I'm Doug Petcash. President Trump's sweeping actions reflect many of his campaign promises while stretching the power of the presidency and moving the country sharply to the right. Here's a comprehensive look at Trump's directives so far through his first week back in the Oval Office.
First, immigration. So far, Trump is ordering the U.S. military to act as immigration and border enforcement officers. He's also redefining birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment. A Trump order claims that a child born in the U.S. is not a citizen if, one, the mother does not have legal immigration status or is in the country legally but only temporarily, and two, the father is not a U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident. This order is already being challenged in federal court. Trump has also ordered federal funding to be cut off for sanctuary cities. Columbus does not label itself as such, but Mayor Andrew Ginther did sign an executive order in 2017 stating city resources would not be used to enforce federal immigration policies. Massive government changes are also underway. The president established the Department of Government Efficiency until July 4th of next year. It's led by the world's richest man, Elon Musk, and is charged with recommending cuts in federal programs and spending. Trump also is making it easier to fire, demote, or reassign career senior executive service officials in the executive branch. Those are generally the highest-ranking civil service employees whose jobs historically have been protected through administration changes. Trump says since they, quote, wield significant government authority, they must serve at the pleasure of the president. He's also making it easier to fire federal workers. The executive order says federal employees and applicants must faithfully implement administration policies, and failure to do so is grounds for dismissal. When it comes to health care, Trump repealed Biden directives intended to make it easier to enroll in Medicaid services, secure insurance coverage under the Affordable Care Act, and lower prescription drug costs. This does not impact the Biden-era $35 monthly cap on insulin for those on Medicare, Medicare's $2,000 annual out-of-pocket cap on prescription drugs, or Medicare's ability to negotiate drug prices. That's because they were passed by Congress. The Trump administration also put a freeze on many federal health agency communications with the public through at least the end of the month. This includes an immediate pause on regulations, announcements, social media posts, and more. The president also withdrew the U.S. from the World Health Organization. And the administration is leading efforts to put an end to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Trump is giving executive branch departments and agencies 60 days to eliminate DEI programs, including all chief diversity officer jobs, equity action plans, and environmental justice positions. It also terminates a 60-year-old executive order setting anti-discrimination requirements for government agencies and contractors. Another action effectively put all federal DEI officers on immediate leave pending their elimination. Trump is also requiring that the U.S. government recognizes only two genders, male and female, on documents including passports. Meanwhile, Trump has not done much during his first week to lower prices for consumers. In fact, nearly all of his moves surround tariffs, something economists say will only raise prices. So far, Trump says he plans to have 25% tariffs on Canadian and Mexican goods as of February 1st, but has not signed such executive action so far. He has begun a review of trade with China to consider new or increased tariffs. And Trump also directed the Treasury and Commerce Secretaries to examine causes of U.S. trade deficits, identify unfair trade practices, and make recommendations, potentially including a global supplemental tariff.
Ohio's J.D. Vance made history himself on Monday, and people in his hometown of Middletown came together to watch it unfold. A small crowd of supporters gathered at Baraka Church in Middletown to witness their hometown boy make history. At 12:01 p.m. on Monday, J.D. Vance took the vice presidential oath of office with his hand on the Bible his great-grandmother gave him. Those we talked to at the watch party say they're proud of the achievements of their native son. The 40-year-old Vance is now the 50th vice president of the U.S. and the first VP from Ohio in about a century.
This is not about a political party. This is about the accomplishments of a man who really rose through very tough, tough times to achieve some great things.
If you support Democrats, if you support Republicans, it doesn't matter. We've got a Middletonian in the White House. That's pretty cool.
The watch party was actually organized by parents of the Middletown High School marching band, color guard, and cheerleaders. The students got to perform for the president and vice president during the inaugural parade, which had to be moved indoors because of the weather. Also in the nation's capital, the day after the inauguration was a big day for one of Ohio's own. Ohio's new U.S. Senator, John Husted, was sworn into office. Governor Mike DeWine picked the former lieutenant governor to replace Vice President J.D. Vance in the Senate. DeWine says he offered the seat to Husted because he has the right skills for the job and believes Husted can win the special election for the office in 2 years. Here's what Husted said on the day the governor announced him as the new senator about his philosophy heading into office.
As a senator, I want to return power from the federal government to the states. States are closer to the problems and can innovate and better than the federal government, especially in education, workforce, and social programs, so we can help more people experience the dignity of work and strengthen the earning power of the middle class.
Governor DeWine will now have to nominate a new lieutenant governor. That nominee must then be confirmed by both the Ohio House and Senate. The governor's press secretary tells me the governor has no timetable for making his choice. Joining me now to discuss all of this from the first week of the new Trump administration are Democratic strategist Morgan Harper and Republican strategist Matt Dole. Thank you both for being here.
Sure.
Really appreciate it.
Travis.
First of all, Matt, we'll start with you. What's your big takeaway from week one of Trump 2.0?
Well, there's been a breadth of policy tackled during the first week, but I think it's the process, how fast it's happening. His nominees are getting movement in the U.S. Senate. He's having these signing parties with all of these folders on the desk where he's signing executive orders. And I think it's just how fast he's getting into work this second term.
How about for you, Morgan? Big takeaway.
I think there's a couple. I mean, we do have to acknowledge that there are policy movements that are happening, that there's the possibility, if they're real, that we could have bipartisan support for, like making the government more efficient. I think a lot of folks would like to see the government save money. But in the background of all of this is that this is an administration that Trump has made very clear is going to be heavily influenced by the largest tech companies on the planet that also have the most money on the planet. And that should concern all of us, in addition to his restriction of power in other parts of government.
One of Trump's most controversial immigration orders seeks to deny birthright citizenship to the children of immigrants who are here in the U.S. illegally or on temporary visas. A judge already halted that. Matt, do you believe for the administration that's the right way to go? What's your take on denying birthright citizenship?
First of all, there's an argument about whether it's constitutional, and I think Trump is inviting the judicial review. By signing this executive order, I think he is inviting the judicial review and letting the Supreme Court decide, does the first half of that sentence in that amendment, is that what counts, or is the what's after the comma in that sentence that no one really wants to talk about, does that count? And that would allow the government to restrict some citizenship. And so I think he's forcing the court to make a decision. That's why it was done by executive order.
Morgan, what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, this certainly is a move for him to placate his base. This is one of the things, immigration, and that you have people who are in this country that are getting the resources necessary to lead successful lives. That was a major plank of his campaign. And so the fact that he moved on that quickly, I think, makes a lot of sense for him politically. I agree with Matt that it is going to force the conversation about our immigration policy in the U.S., but also the Constitution is the Constitution, and we would expect that our president would uphold that. So this will be interesting. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think we also need to acknowledge that a lot of the issues that people have with our immigration policy are also connected to the larger promise that Trump made, which was he was going to improve people's economic lives. And whether or not he can do that, reducing the cost of living, bringing down inflation, very much remains to be seen.
He also pardoned more than 1,500 January 6th defendants, insurrection defendants. And, you know, some Republicans, including Lisa Murkowski, have criticized or at least expressed surprise that it was a blanket pardon for the folks who were charged or convicted in January 6th. Morgan, what message do you think that sends with his blanket pardon?
I think he's emboldening people and his most ardent supporters to do pretty much whatever they want if they think that they're going to be protected by the MAGA movement, would be my take on that.
Matt?
I think what surprises me is that people continue to be surprised when Trump follows through on what he says. He said he was going to pardon these folks, especially after Joe Biden followed through on the pardons that Joe Biden followed through on. And then we're all aghast that he does a blanket pardon. He promised to do this. He said he was going to do it. He did it. And by the way, he has the right to do it.
I don't think. Go ahead, Marty.
Well, but even if it's following through on a promise, not all promises are worthy of making. And this is one that really gets at what do we stand for as a country? Are we going to allow people, enable them, and say it's okay if you threaten the lives of sitting members of Congress, law enforcement officers, if you are desecrating sacred buildings that are part of a Capitol that your people from your own party were part of? So, you know, I completely agree. Again, politically, makes a lot of sense. But for us as a country, what does it mean for us moving forward? Troubling.
It sounded like the big concern, too, was not for some of the people maybe who didn't do anything violent, but the most violent offenders that people were surprised
by. Yeah, I think the problem is that the lawfare attacked everybody. Right. And so Trump's actions, pardons, it's a blanket pardon. But the overwhelming majority of folks of those 1500 weren't violent, attacking police, everything else. And the problem started when Biden prosecutors went after those folks.
OK. Morgan, I'll start with you on this one. The president effectively ended all diversity, equity and inclusion, as I explained in the setup here a few couple of minutes ago. What impact do you think that will have as he puts all the people on leave and is ending those programs on the federal level?
I think it's going to have an immediate impact. I mean, an executive order doesn't immediately influence how different agencies are managed. In theory, they do. But for example, Joe Biden ordered the Federal Reserve to immediately review bank merger guidelines. Well, that never happened in the Federal Reserve. They just decided not to do that. So it's not a guarantee. But I do think, especially in this case, in the political environment around DEI issues, a lot of heads of agencies are going to take that seriously. It'll trickle throughout different parts of the economy beyond the government, that you're going to see companies that are also going to be increasingly nervous about having DEI programs. And that's a concern because ultimately, you know, we do what a lot of DEI programs are getting at are making sure that everyone has a place in the workplace, including disabled, including women. But I think there's also, again, this is the tricky thing with a lot of Trump issues. There is a kernel of a core issue that we do need to talk about, which is, you know, a lot of black people did support Donald Trump, some for sure, and are looking to make sure that we're getting ahead. And if DEI programs weren't effectively doing that, then that's a real conversation that we need to have. But Trump's not getting into the nuance. He's doing blanket statements, as we've been talking about. And this ultimately, overall, is going to have a real chilling effect on folks feeling that they can have those inclusive programs.
Do you agree with that or disagree?
No, I think I generally agree with that. I think I have a more cynical look at the whether it will be successful or not. You know, there was a graphic that came out from the ATF where Ohio and Steve Dettelbeck was the director and their DEI chief reported directly to him. A new organizational chart was released after he left. He was removed from that organizational chart, Steve Dettelbeck was, and the DEI chief became a senior advisor. And so I think that there's some cynicism on the left, on the right, about whether this will actually happen and get done and what the president will have to do to see his...
Meaning that there's some of those people in the positions will just be shifted or
retitled? Exactly.
Okay. So obviously a very busy first week. What are you expecting in like week two? And a lot of times people look at that first 100 days.
Yeah, I think we're going to see more of the same. I think we are going to have to see the sort of cycling of the legal reviews of a lot of these things. I mean, everybody has talked mostly about the birthright executive order. But Congress passed a law saying TikTok needed to shut down by X date. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court said that's true, TikTok needs to shut down by this date. And Donald Trump signed an executive order saying no, TikTok doesn't have to shut down. That is in direct conflict with the Congress of the United States.
And the Supreme Court.
So those sorts of things need to play out. And then, of course, he'll get more and more of his nominees through the U.S. Senate, and we'll start to see those departments come into action.
What are you thinking for the next...
Well, excited to agree with Matt again. I mean, I do think we need to continue to pay very close attention to how much President Trump is flouting the balance of powers in our United States government. He is disregarding the Supreme Court. We now are also seeing members of Congress who are supporting him. We have a bill that was introduced to try to allow him to have another term, to change the Constitution, to extend him into a third term, potentially. These are very concerning moves for democracy overall. But I do hope that we are going to continue to have a conversation that President Trump has engaged in already on trade. That's going to be a very hot topic, in addition to TikTok. And I hope that we will see some movement on this DOGE effort. The ability to make government more efficient is something that I think a lot of Americans support, but we need to be honest about the fact that the main driver of spending in our government is defense, and that is a lot of defense contractors that are gouging us as taxpayers, and that Republicans would focus on that as a top priority.
We just have a little bit of time left, and I did want to touch on our new senator. Senator Bernie Moreno is obviously new, but even newer than he is, Senator John Husted just sworn in this past week. Matt, what kind of senator do you think he'll make?
Yeah, it was a pretty cool moment. It was the fourth time in U.S. history where a vice president has sworn in his own successor. It was sort of a unique moment in history. I think John Husted is going to work in the U.S. Senate with Bernie Moreno to see through Donald Trump's agenda. I think that's the kind of senator he's going to be. People question whether he's a true conservative or not. I think John Husted, going back to when he was Speaker of the House and Secretary of State, is a strong conservative. He served Mike DeWine well as lieutenant governor, but he's gonna be the sort of senator you expect a Republican senator to be.
Morgan, what do you expect?
Well, I think that's a great question. What does it mean to be a Republican senator in 2025? There are two factions within the Republican Party that are odds with each other, one that is very much on the side of protecting big business. Husted has represented that faction along with Mike DeWine for his entire career, and we have a MAGA movement that has moved the party in a different direction. And that's where a lot of members in Congress are also battling over these lines. I think it's going to be very tricky political terrain for John Husted if he expects to hold on to that seat moving forward.
Got to run for it again in 2 years with a special election coming up. Matt Dole, thank you so much. Morgan Harper, appreciate your perspective on this. Let's do it again sometime.
Sounds great.
All right. Thank you so much.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
In one of his first acts back in office, President Trump pardoned about 1,500 January 6th defendants. Dozens of Ohioans are among them. I talked to a Columbus man just hours after he got out of prison. Kyle Campbell pleaded guilty to one count of assault on a police officer for his role on January 6th of 2021. He just started serving his four-month sentence on January 9th. 11 days later, President Trump pardoned him, and before he knew it, he was a free man again.
Kyle Campbell was just reunited with his four-year-old daughter. He wanted her with him for our interview. Campbell says only about 30 minutes after President Trump signed the pardons, corrections officers at the federal prison in Michigan came to get him from his unit.
They were walking fast, and I hear a guy just yell, "Campbell!" And he comes down, and he comes to me and says, "Grab your stuff, anything you need."
2 hours later, he was free. 3 years ago, he says he found himself caught up in the mob at the U.S. Capitol.
What did you do on January 6th?
I went just with the intention of just going to see it. You know, I've been a Trump supporter since 2016, and it just seemed like it was going to be a good time. I had questions about the 2020 election.
Campbell admits he was wrong in going on to the U.S. Capitol grounds. He says video shown in court shows he was pushed from behind into a police officer twice, and that led to the assault on an officer charge against him.
I get pushed back into the police officer. I've got my hands up now. More of a defensive thing. I'm in a mob of people and a police line right in front of me. And that's what landed me in prison for 11 days.
Did you ever go inside the building?
I did not.
Why not?
I don't know. It just didn't seem like a good idea. I never went with any intention of causing any disruption or anything like that. Like I said, I got caught up in the energy of what was happening.
Any regrets?
I regret that I was in a mob, for sure. I regret that I let my own free will be swayed by a group. I didn't hurt anybody. I didn't damage any property.
Campbell feels fortunate he was sentenced to only 4 months in prison and that he served only 11 days of that.
What do you think about President Trump's pardon?
I think it's a wonderful thing that he did. I think he made a promise to people. People were there for him.
And calls this all a character-building experience.
I do know I was in the wrong. I do know I broke the law. And I think taking accountability for your actions is important.
What's your message to your daughter?
Take accountability. Be strong and be yourself.
Campbell tells me he feels that he was treated fairly by the FBI, the judge in his case, and the corrections officers while he was in prison. He sells insurance and says that he has a job waiting for him.
Respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, is a common seasonal virus, but it can have major implications on a patient's heart health. Most RSV cases involve mild cold-like symptoms, but up to 160,000 adults are hospitalized each year for more serious cases. And RSV can escalate chronic health issues. If you're over the age of 60, talk to your doctor to find out if the new RSV vaccine is right for you. And learn more at heart.org/RSV.
Victor deployed for the first time to Afghanistan in 2003. He sustained a moderate traumatic brain injury. One of the most important elements of caregiving is taking care of yourself.
For many military veteran caregivers, their caregiving journey starts earlier in life and lasts longer. Visit aarp.org/caregiving for a free military veteran's guide to navigate your caregiving journey and better care for your loved one and yourself. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Now to the State House, where Republican lawmakers introduced a bill that would make big changes to higher education in Ohio. Sponsors say Senate Bill 1, known as the Advance Ohio Higher Education Act, will guarantee and enhance free speech and diversity of thought on campus. It would also ban all diversity, equity, and inclusion courses and training and prohibit faculty from striking. Bill's sponsor, State Senator Jerry Serino, says the bill would also prohibit universities and professors from taking positions on controversial subjects.
Doesn't mean they can't be discussed in a classroom. They certainly should. But they need to be balanced and not indoctrinating in nature.
Opponents protested in the hallway outside the room where the news conference was held. They argue the legislators are attacking higher education by shutting down, not opening up, intellectual diversity. They also call the bill government overreach.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.